The headlines: at least 10 Afghan civilians, including 6 children, are killed in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul. The Taliban say that they will seek friendly ties with all countries around the world once a government is established in Afghanistan. Also in the headlines, Tehran says Washington is in no position to prevent its fuel supply to Lebanon, which is suffering from a severe energy crisis. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. This is Ms. At least 10 civilians, including 6 children, are killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. That is according to the relatives of the victims. The deaths occurred after a car parked inside of a home was struck by a U.S. drone on Sunday. Earlier, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid confirmed 7 deaths in the strike. He condemned Washington's action unlawful, saying that the U.S. should have informed the Taliban before launching such an attack. Meanwhile, several rockets were fired at Kabul International Airport, but were intercepted by a missile defense system. The Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility for the rocket fire. The developments come as the U.S. is racing against time to complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Journalist and political analyst Brian Biletich says that the chaos in Afghanistan is the result of 20 years of U.S. military presence there.
This is 20 years of U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan unraveling before everyone's eyes. They're claiming that they're leaving Afghanistan because they have accomplished their mission of preventing the country from being used as a safe haven for terrorism. And at the same time, they're claiming ISIS or Daesh is attacking them as they're withdrawing. So obviously that's not true. They are conducting these over-the-horizon drone strikes that are most likely flying out of either Qatar or the United Arab Emirates. Both of these countries have been identified by the U.S. as state sponsors of terrorism, including of Daesh or ISIS. So everything we're seeing now in Afghanistan, it looks chaotic because this is 20 years of lies unraveling. And the U.S. cannot cover off what they've done there any longer.
The Taliban say that they will seek friendly ties with all countries around the world once a government is established in Afghanistan. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said that the worries, concerns that some countries have, can be resolved through diplomacy. Mujahid called on the U.S. and other Western countries not to stand in their way. He also noted that the group is serious about forming a government as soon as possible. Mujahid said once foreign troops leave the country, no terror group, including Daesh, will have any excuse to operate on Afghan soil. Tehran says the U.S. and other countries are in no position to block the legitimate fuel trade between Iran and Lebanon. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says that the choice of the country to which Tehran sells its oil and its fuel is a sovereign issue. Saeed Khatibzadeh stressed that such legitimate trade is a clear international right of any nation, and that Iran is very serious in exercising its sovereignty. Iran has dispatched a third fuel shipment to Lebanon to help ease the country's energy crisis, which Hezbollah blames on U.S. sanctions. Israeli sources say the resistance movement is on alert to react to any hostile move by the regime against the Lebanon-bound Iranian tanker after it entered the Mediterranean. Iran's foreign minister is in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Following his trip to Iraq, Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the presence of foreign forces will not contribute to sustainable security and stability in the region. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali reports.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty, and independence in our world. We lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle in their fight for their legitimate rights.
Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people in the fight on terror and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The World Health Organization warns about another 236,000 COVID-19-related deaths in Europe by December the 1st.
Several countries are starting to observe an increased burden on hospitals and more deaths. Last week, there was an 11% increase in the number of deaths in the region, with one reliable projection expecting 236,000 deaths in Europe by December 1st.
The WHO's European director said 33 states in Europe have registered a death rate of over 10% in the last 2 weeks. Hans Kluge described the high transmission rates across the continent as deeply worrying. He attributed the rise in infections on the more contagious Delta variant, the easing of restrictions, and a surge in summer travel. Kluge noted that even though around half of Europe's population is fully inoculated, vaccination uptake in the region has slowed down. He said the decline in vaccination is of serious concern, while urging countries to increase production and sharing of vaccines. Official figures show that Germany's annual consumer price inflation has jumped to its highest level since 2008. The German Federal Statistical Office said consumer prices rose by 3.4% in August, compared with 3.1% in July. This comes as Europe's largest economy is reeling from the fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, with companies struggling with supply shortages. Experts believe the current increase in Germany's consumer prices is likely to remain temporary. However, the German Central Bank has warned that inflation could hover above 2% until mid-2022. Iran has inaugurated the largest COVID vaccination center in its east. The new medical facility was built as the country is scrambling to contain the unabated surge of the coronavirus death toll. Yusuf Jalali reports from Mashhad.
This is the so far largest COVID vaccination center in east of Iran. Based in the northeastern city of Mashhad, the medical facility has the capacity to inoculate a whopping 10,000 people every day. The privately owned facility was launched with the attendance of state officials in Mashhad.
This facility offers the space and infrastructure needed to conduct the vaccination. The vaccines and vaccinators will be provided by the health ministry.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 7 million people. That's less than 10% of the population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms like the Delta variant has been killing an average of 500 Iranians every day. The new Iranian administration, led by President Raisi, has vowed to import millions of vaccines in the coming months. And Parliament says it's ready to offer any help to achieve this goal.
The president has tasked the foreign ministry with negotiating with different countries over the purchase of 60 million doses of COVID vaccines. We hope that this can be achieved by early October. If this happens, we could vaccinate all of the most vulnerable groups within the next 2 months.
In addition to the import of foreign vaccines, Iran is also trying to ramp up the production of domestically made jabs, such as Coviran, which has so far injected more than 1.5 million doses in the country. Neura and Cove Pars are among the local vaccines that are expected to hit the market in the next few months.
Figures show that every 3 minutes, one Iranian dies of the coronavirus. And this is not the peak yet. Now, as vaccination is viewed as the ultimate terminator of the pandemic, Iran says it will build more such vaccination centers across the country to speed up the so far sluggish inoculation trend in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
Israeli forces have demolished yet another Palestinian home in the occupied territory. Bulldozers, backed by Israeli troops, destroyed a house in Jabal Mukaber village in East Al-Quds. This is the latest in a series of demolitions carried out by Israeli forces in the occupied territories in recent days. Israel demolishes Palestinian homes and structures on a regular basis, citing different pretexts, including the lack of a construction permit. Palestinians and rights groups say that the demolitions are aimed at grabbing more land for Israeli settlement expansions. Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have lashed out at President Mahmoud Abbas for meeting with the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz. The Hamas described the move as a stab in the back of Palestinians, saying that Abbas has abandoned national values. The resistance movement called for a united front against such humiliating behavior. Another group, the Islamic Jihad Movement, also slammed the meeting, saying that the Palestinian president is boosting ties with the enemy. Abbas and Gantz met on Sunday in the West Bank city of Ramallah. The two discussed a number of issues, including security and economic situations in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Clashes have erupted between Israeli forces and Palestinians near the separation barrier with the Gaza Strip. A number of Palestinians were injured as a result. During our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review section. Do stay with us. Israeli forces have violently clashed with Palestinians protesting near the so-called buffer zone in the Gaza Strip against years of Israeli siege of that territory. Nearly 20 Palestinians got injured after the regime forces attacked protesters who were venting their anger by burning tires and chanting anti-Israel slogans. Some protesters also threw stones and Molotov cocktails at Israeli forces. Demonstrators said that they would continue their protests until the regime lifted its crippling blockade on the people of Gaza. At least 11 Palestinians were injured in similar protests on Saturday after Israeli forces resorted to live fire in tear gas. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The siege and several Israeli wars have destroyed the Gaza economy. In 2018, people there launched a protest movement demanding an end to Israel's blockade and the right for Palestinians to return to the land they were forcibly expelled from after the creation of Israel in 1948. Now let's get some information and insight on this. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, in Gaza City. We'll also be joined by Mustafa Barghouti, who is with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Gaza City to Ashraf and to get an update regarding the latest going on the ground there, Ashraf, and all the issues and problems that the people in Gaza are facing in the presence of this blockade that has been there. And also recently we have this escalation of violence against Palestinians.
Yes, Behrouz, the Israeli regime forces yesterday injured close to 2 dozen Palestinians protesting at the east of the northern Gaza Strip refugee camp of Jabalia. While over the last 2 weeks, Israeli forces killed two protesters, including a 12-year-old boy. This is what's happening nowadays in the Gaza Strip, close to the so-called buffer zone in the east of the enclave, is similar to the Great March of Return peaceful rallies that began on March 30th, 2018. To demand the right of return for millions of Palestinian refugees and the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade. During those peaceful protests, Israeli forces killed some 300 protesters, including medics and also journalists. Israel continues to use excessive force against peaceful protesters. For example, that 12-year-old boy who was shot two weeks ago, he was shot in the neck by a live bullet and succumbed to his wounds a week later.
Now, let's turn to Ramallah. Mr. Barghouti, Palestinians need to be meeting each other, and we're expecting that to happen because since a year ago they were talking about putting aside their differences and uniting. What's happened to that?
What happened is that after we met and agreed, and we agreed on three major things. One is to establish a unified national leadership for the Palestinian Popular Nonviolent Resistance. And we agreed on having elections, presidential elections, legislative council elections, and elections for the Palestinian National Council. Unfortunately, later, the PA canceled all of that. The national unified national leadership was not established really, and the popular nonviolent resistance was not adopted fully as it should. But the more important thing is that the Palestinian Authority and the president canceled the election. And by canceling the elections, he practically canceled all the results of the dialogue that we had together. That's why I think going back to unity requires three major conditions. One is an acceptance of the principle of democratic participation of all Palestinian groups without exception. Second is to bring back the elections and establish an immediate date for the elections to take place, including in Jerusalem, despite Israeli obstruction. And third, that the Palestinian Authority should say clearly that they are ready for a new strategy, a new platform that does not make build hopes only on negotiations and on Oslo agreement, but on enhancing the Palestinian struggle for its rights against occupation and against the system of apartheid and discrimination.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shannon in Gaza City and Mustafa Barghouti with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah joined us with their comments and contribution. That's it for this edition of the News Review.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today I have come to my grandma's home. I have come here in order to help my grandma in organizing her books and dusting her little bookshelf. This shelf has the collections of poems of great Iranian poets. This is the Divan of Hafez. Oh, how beautiful the miniature is. And it's the Golestan of Saadi. And, this is the collection of Khayyam's quatrains. Oh, it's so dusty. while I dust and sort out the books, get yourself ready for a new tour. Today we are going to visit a big library in Tehran, to the National Library of Iran. The first building of the National Library of Iran was built next to the building of National Museum of Iran. This building was designed by French architect and archaeologist André Godard. The National Library of Iran was officially opened in 1937. Years later, in 1961, a new building was attached to the library. In 2005, the new building of the National Library of Iran was established. The new 8-story building has been constructed in an area of 97,000 square meters. The new building of the National Library of Iran is seismic resistant and is so strong that can even withstand earthquakes measuring 9 on the Richter scale. The National Library of Iran has the capacity to house 4 to 7 million books. I am now in the area of the National Library of Iran. Here is a very green, beautiful environment, and just across from me, there is a big building. It's a brick-made building. This building gives me the kind of sense which buildings with Iranian architecture radiate, a sense of peace and calm. Let's go inside. The National Library of Iran has 9 study halls, each named after an Iranian renowned person. I am now in Khwarazmi Hall, which is very big. This hall has rare and manuscript books. In Khwarazmi Hall, a rich collection of manuscripts and lithographs are kept. I am now in Rudaki Study Hall. This hall is dedicated to people with low vision or blindness. Several people are studying in this hall, and I better not to disturb them. Oh my God, this library is so huge. I don't think I could visit all the study halls. It takes much time. Well, the structure of the National Library of Iran has stair-like and pyramid-like architecture. This architectural characteristic has made it appropriate for the main spaces and study halls to enjoy the natural light. I should bring my grandma to this library. Sure, she will like it. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
We tried to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
One of the qualities of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is the quality of basira. If Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas did not see where it is necessary to use this, at what point and when not to use it, that great skill of Abbas, the bravery of Abbas, would not have been glowing the way it is. The reason why Abbas shines up to today, Qamaru Bani Hashim still shines, is not because the skill by itself. Let me give you another example. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya is the brother of Abbas. They're both children of Amir al-Mu'mineen Haydar al-Karrar. Amir al-Mu'mineen trained Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya as well. Look at the lines Amir al-Mu'mineen has to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya. Really, by the way, very nice lines that we need to look at on a different topic, address that and learn from it. Amir al-Mu'mineen in the Battle of Siffin gives the flag, gives the banner to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya and says, you see the end of Muawiyah's camp? The end of it, we're facing all these 75,000 soldiers that Muawiyah has brought from Sham. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, you see the end of it? Aim for that. Don't aim for the few guys here. You're going way out there. And then one of the lines Amir al-Mu'mineen has to him is, A'irillah jumjumatek, the skull of yours, which represents life. He says, give this as a trust to Allah. I'm giving it to you. And it's interesting, Amir al-Mu'mineen uses the word A'irillah. I'ara is something you give, you take back. In other words, when you're going and fighting for Allah, while you want shahada, while you want to be killed in the way of Allah, you want to complete the task. God, I'm giving this to you. You protect this till I get to the end of the army of the enemies. Amir al-Mu'mineen trains Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya as well. They're both the children of Ali ibn Abi Talib. They share the blood of Ali ibn Abi Talib. in those battles, what's been recorded, is great bravery, chivalry. But Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, besides the nafsani problems, besides the issues that clearly he had, that Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas didn't, so pure, As-salamu alayk ayyuha al-abdu al-salih, al-muti' lillah. Read his ziyarah when you go over there to Karbala. We've been taught to say this. Ayyuha al-abd al-salih, the servant of Allah, the reformed, the good servant and slave of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Al-muti' lillah, he was obedient. The nafsani issues aside, in his conversation with Imam al-Husayn, we're talking about this judgment of the conditions. That is what will help with the basira. Right now the focus is basira itself. Look at the conversation of Imam al-Husayn with Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya. And look at the lack of conversation as far as we know. I have not seen any record of Imam al-Husayn even wanting to talk to Abbas that you should come, and then him saying, well, let me think about it. He's not a child. Although, as we said, even the children of Karbala didn't come without thinking, without knowing, without understanding. But Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is a grown man. He knows what he's doing. He thinks. There's no conversation. He came along without having to be spoken to. Not only did he not object, he didn't even have to be spoken to. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya looks at the conditions. He understands where the Ahlul Bayt come from. He's from that physical house. He's not one of the Ahlul Bayt in either the sense of the Ma'sumin or the sense that Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is. If we have hadith that Salman minna Ahlul Bayt, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is beyond that. He's definitely of the Ahlul Bayt, but not of the 14 Ma'sumin. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya is not on that level, but he's physically in the house. He's seen things. He knows. He's heard Amir al-Mu'mineen. He was part of the struggle in the 5 years of governance of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He saw what happened with Imam al-Mujtaba. He didn't oppose that. He's been in this house. He's known the plans of the Ahlul Bayt, Imam al-Mujtaba, Imam al-Husayn. He's known all of that. Now the time comes, the plan that was known, that when Muawiyah dies, we have got to make a move. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya looks at the conditions. What's his judgment? This is what basira is, understanding the conditions that you're in. His judgment is, rising now will lead to nothing but death. What does this mean? It means there's no outcome. There's no positive result. There's no reason. It's spilling one's blood in vain. In other words, suicide. It's suicide. His judgment of the conditions is suicide. You're going to go out there. I understand what you're saying. I agree with you. Obviously, I don't agree with Yazid. I don't think they should be in power. I fought these people in Siffin myself. But what are we supposed to do towards them? Are these the times when everybody has pledged allegiance during the life of Muawiyah to Yazid? They have gained control over all these regions. They've expanded their territory, the riches at their disposal, people listening to them. It's worse than the time of Siffin. In Siffin, we were 45,000 people against 75,000 people. Now you don't have 45,000 people, you don't even have 1,000 people. If you go out, perhaps he's even thinking the following. Imam al-Mujtaba signed a treaty, you were with him. At those times, you had more than a few hundred people that would follow you. They would go and fight Muawiyah. You had more than a few thousand. Yeah, sure, Muawiyah had 70, 80, I don't know, whatever number of thousands of soldiers. The Ahlul Bayt, you had 1,000 soldiers, 2,000 soldiers, 3,000 soldiers. Now you don't have any of that. If you go out, you refuse to pledge allegiance to Yazid, and you decide to rise against him, if you do that, it will result in nothing but spilling your blood, and that means suicide. Don't put your life in danger with no results. Sure, if there is in a battlefield, again, using arguments that perhaps he's thinking, I was in Siffin, I risked my life, but it's a risk that's worthy. I may get killed, but with these numbers, we can win this battle. We would get rid of Muawiyah, get rid of the problem. You have an army, it makes sense. Those who die, they become shaheed. That's shahada. But if you go now, there'll be no outcome. They'll just kill you, massacre you, no result. Take your family as... This is his judgment. These are his words, not with all the extra explanations I give. I'm trying to elaborate. I'm giving you a commentary on the words that Muhammad ibn al-Hafiyah has spoken to Imam al-Husayn, salamullah alayhi. The judgment of Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyah in these conditions as someone that's part of this camp. He's not someone... The reason why we say we focus on an individual like this and we talk about his flaws is for us to learn from, because he was from this camp. We're not talking about someone that's outside of this camp. We're not talking about Marwan ibn Hakam the Mal'un, who was trying to convince the governor of Medina to kill Imam al-Husayn right there. We're talking about Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyah. He's a Sayyid beyond what usually we call Sayyid. He's the direct son of Ali ibn Abi Talib. He's been in that camp. Look at his judgment of these conditions. Obviously, Imam al-Husayn's judgment of the condition is different. Imam al-Husayn's judgment of Yazid, his judgment of the conditions of the Ummah, the judgment of the measures that need to be taken and will give the results and bear the fruits of reviving the Sunnah of the Prophet, his judgment is that actually, this is the time to rise. Whether we are able to get a few thousand people to fight along our side against the governor of Kufa or some other governor somewhere else, or we don't and we are massacred. The judgment of Imam al-Husayn is, at this time, unlike the time of Imam al-Mujtaba and the Treaty of Muawiyah, at this time, if they massacre us, we win. If they take our family as prisoners of war, we win. If we're left alone, we win. Obviously, if we're not left alone, we win. That wasn't something that there was a dispute. He knew. But both their judgments was that we won't get enough support. Imam al-Husayn knew that. He was more clever. But the judgment is here. If we don't get that support and they massacre us, his judgment is, it'll be in vain, it's suicide. Imam al-Husayn's judgment is what? It won't be in vain, it'll save Islam. That's Imam al-Husayn's judgment.
Ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The unexpected and unwelcome coronavirus surge now unfolding in the United States has hit hardest in states that were slow to embrace vaccines. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Patricia Mazai, Benjamin Muller, and Robert Gabaloff. The piece is titled, What Went Wrong with the Pandemic in Florida? Stay with us for more. Unexpected and unwelcome coronavirus surge now unfolding in the United States has hit hardest in states that were slow to embrace vaccines. And then there is Florida. While leaders in that state also refused lockdowns and mask orders, they made it a priority to vaccinate vulnerable older people. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, opened mass vaccination sites and sent teams to retirement communities and nursing homes. Younger people also lined up for vaccine shots. Governor Ron DeSantis and public health experts expected a rise in cases this summer as people gathered indoors in the air conditioning. But what happened was much worse. Cases spiraled out of control, reaching peaks higher than Florida had seen before. Hospitalizations followed, so did deaths, which are considerably higher than the numbers currently reached anywhere else in the United States. It's a very sad, sad moment for all of us, said Natalie E. Dean, a biostatistician at Emory University who until recently worked at the University of Florida and has closely followed the pandemic in the state. It was really hard to imagine us ever getting back to this place. The Florida story is a cautionary tale for dealing with the current incarnation of the coronavirus. The United States has used the vaccines as its primary pandemic weapon, but Florida shows that even a state that made a major push for vaccinations, Florida ranks 21st among states and Washington, D.C., in giving people of all ages at least one vaccine shot, can be crushed by the Delta variant, reaching frightening levels of hospitalizations and deaths. Clearly, the vaccines are keeping most of these people out of the hospital, but we're not building the herd immunity that people hoped, Ron DeSantis said at a news conference this past week. You've got a huge percentage of people, adults, that have gotten vaccine shots, and yet you've still seen a wave. Morgues and crematoriums are full or getting there. Public utilities in Orlando and Tampa have asked residents to cut back on water usage so liquid oxygen, which is used in water treatment, can be conserved for hospitals. As of Friday, 27th of August, Florida was recording an average of 242 virus deaths a day, nearly as many as California and Texas combined, though a few states still had a higher per capita rate, according to public health data tracked by the New York Times. Florida's pandemic data, more scant since the state ended its declared COVID-19 state of emergency in June, reveals only limited information about who is dying. Hospitals have said upward of 90% of their patients have been unvaccinated. Exactly why the state has been so hard hit remains an elusive question. Other states with comparable vaccine coverage have a small fraction of Florida's hospitalization rate. The best explanation of what has happened is that Florida's vaccination rates were good, but not good enough for its demographics. It has so many older people that even vaccinating a vast majority of them left more than 800,000 unprotected. Vaccination rates among younger people were uneven, so clusters of people remained at risk. Previous virus waves, which were milder than in some other states, conferred only some natural immunity. And Florida is Florida. People have enjoyed many months of party going and traveling, all activities conducive to swift virus spread. Unlike in places like Oregon, which is clamping down again, adopting even outdoor mask mandates, Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, continues to stay the course. hoping to power through despite the devastating human toll. A Quinnipiac University opinion poll released this past week found that Ron DeSantis' approval rating was 47%. He and other Florida state officials have sought to steer away from measures that could curtail infections, banning strict mask mandates in public schools. The biggest school districts imposed them anyway, and on Friday, a state judge ruled that Florida could not prevent those mandates, a decision the Department of Education plans to appeal. Florida has experienced more deaths than normal, from all causes, not just COVID-19, throughout the pandemic. In the early weeks of 2021, with cases surging and the vaccine rollout kicking off, the state averaged 5,600 deaths each week, about a third more than typical for that time of the year, according to mortality figures from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The deaths dropped and then went back up again. These excess deaths are important, both because a number of COVID-19 deaths occur outside of hospitals and because the virus may contribute to deaths from other causes as a result of the strain on the healthcare system. In the first week of August, the state recorded another 5,600 deaths. But because mortality rates normally drop during summer months, the figure was more than 50% above what's typical. "We're seeing a ton of people calling us to report the COVID deaths," said Dr. Stephen J. Nelson, the Polk County medical examiner. "They're typically young people that have been sick for a while. The picture of who is dying, however, is complicated. About 82% of people 65 and older in the state are fully vaccinated, about average for the nation. That has still left a relatively large number of older people, about 819,000, unvaccinated or only partially vaccinated," said Jason Salemi, an epidemiologist at the University of South Florida. "If the unvaccinated also take fewer other precautions," he added, "that would put them directly in the virus's path." "The Delta variant is exceptional at finding vulnerable populations," he said. "The situation in nursing homes, where infections can spread swiftly, has also been problematic. While vaccination rates among older Floridans as a whole have been good, the rate of nursing home residents who are fully vaccinated, an average of 73.1% in each home, is lower than every state but Nevada, according to the CDC. About 47.5% of nursing home staff members were fully vaccinated as of 15th of August, the lowest of any state but Louisiana. Older people are also more likely to have immune deficiencies and comorbidities, making them more susceptible to breakthrough infections and hospitalizations, noted Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. "And some, though not all, data have suggested that immunity against infection has waned in older, vaccinated adults. The Biden administration has indicated that those people will be among the first in line for booster vaccine shots. Then there are the younger people who now make up a larger share of Florida virus deaths. Before 25th of June, people under the age of 65 made up 22% of deaths. Since then, that proportion has risen to 28%. 56% of people between the ages of 12 and 64 in Florida's 10 largest counties are fully vaccinated, which is consistent with national figures. But in the rest of the state, that figure is only 43%, and in 27 counties, less than 1 in 3 residents in the age group is fully vaccinated. The heart-wrenching deaths of children remain rare. The deaths of young and middle-aged adults have become routine. "My mom had no prior illnesses. She was strong as an ox," said Trey Burrows, whose 50-year-old mother, Cindy Dawkins, died from COVID-19 on 7th of August. "There was literally nothing wrong with her. This just came out of nowhere." Ms. Dawkins, a mother of four who worked in a restaurant in Boynton Beach, Florida, began to feel ill shortly before her birthday, as the family was en route to celebrate in Orlando. Ms. Dawkins developed a cough and shortness of breath. 4 days later, she went to hospital. Doctors placed her on a ventilator. 32 hours later, she was dead. Her son said she had not gotten vaccinated because she feared possible side effects. Those who did not get vaccinated are only part of the explanation behind the surge. Many states slammed by the virus earlier developed deep reservoirs of natural immunity from prior infections, affording them higher levels of protection than would be evident from vaccination rates alone.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura? February 8, 2010. Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, did not have to endure the psychological pains that Zainab al-Kubra went through. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains, the invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." On the day of Ashura, she said, "Oh God, accept this from us." While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, "O God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty."
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana la chan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. See how different this position, this patience, and this love of justice and truth are compared to Asiya's position described in the Holy Quran. This shows the greatness of Zainab's position. This is the nature of actions that are carried out for the sake of God. Therefore, Zainab's actions are currently a model, and her name and achievements will remain until the end of time. The permanence of Islam and the divine path and continuation of this path by God's servants are based on what Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam and Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, did. That is to say, as a result of the great patience, resistance, and endurance of hardships, you see that religious values have gained a lot of ground in the modern world. All these human values, which are consistent with human nature in different schools of thoughts, are rooted in religious values. These values have been promoted by religion. That is the nature of efforts for a divine cause.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.